Peter B. Collins with news and comments. It is Thursday, March 21st, 2013. Opening up with a little harmonica riff. That's my old pal, Charlie Musselwhite, a harp veteran. He went to Australia to record that with NXS back in the mid-1980s. You wanna make a suicide blunt. And it reminds me, I owe a shout-out to our loyal listener, Hamish, in Australia. He emailed last week. We were talking about the new Pope. And I used the term imprimatur, which he prefers to pronounce imprimatur. And I think he's probably right. Mine is probably okay, a secondary. But he gave me a good definition, much better than the one I used. And I won't bore you with it, but Hamish, thank you for your attention to detail and language. I value that. I also value fish that won't kill me. And I am pleased to see that where the federal government's regulatory scheme and where the efforts of voters in states like California have so far failed, we have market forces stepping in to reject frankenfish. This is a very important step. And I have problems with the guy who founded Whole Foods. He's not a good labor guy, and he's kind of all over the map on certain issues. But Whole Foods and Trader Joe's are setting the tone. Despite the approval of genetically engineered salmon by the Food and Drug Administration, these retailers have said, nope, you will not find frankenfish in our stores. They're also joined by Aldi stores in the eastern part of the U.S., not familiar with them, and PCC Natural Markets in the state of Washington. And I predict that others will join forces. And I don't shop at Whole Foods. Frankly, I can't afford it. I go in there and I look and I graze, and the prices just send me right back out the door. But those of you who can find a parking space in the Whole Foods lot, and if you haven't seen it yet, go to YouTube and put in Getting Real in the Whole Foods parking lot. Very funny little music ditty video that somebody put together. But Whole Foods is also stepping in where California voters were unable to impose a simple requirement on food producers that any food product that contains GMOs, genetically modified organisms, must be labeled as such. There's no ban. There's no penalty. Simply put it on the package. And that measure was trending to pass last fall, Prop 37. In September, it was up by at least 10 points, maybe more. And then Monsanto and their corporate cronies in agribusiness and food retailing, and the guys who make junk food, they pumped more than $40 million into deceptive television ads, and the measure lost. But Whole Foods has said that by 2018, any product that it sells in its stores must be clearly labeled. And because Whole Foods is such a powerful retail force now, this could do what voters were unable to do. Because if you want to sell your chips, organic or otherwise, at Whole Foods, you're going to have to label whether it contains GMO elements or not. Now, you can still comment at the FDA. The period is until April 26, but for 17 years, they've been looking for ways to approve the genetically modified fish. And this is really the first case of this kind of border being crossed over. The first transgenic animal to enter our food supply chain. And I'm as wary of frankenfish as I am of farmed fish. And I'll wait and see if they can show us studies that these genetically modified salmon are not tainted with PCBs the way farmed fish are. I might take another look in the future. But at minimum, we all deserve to know what elements are in the foods that we buy, prepare, and eat. Well, as Congress gets ready to shove off for a 2-week spring break, First, the Senate passed a bill on Wednesday, which basically locks in most of the sequester cuts, the $85 billion in bad spending cuts that were imposed March 1st. But it refused to fund White House tours that the Obama administration has shut down. I think that's a pretty silly budget cut myself. But they did make some adjustments. In the Senate bill, federal meat inspectors were spared furloughs. And there are other cuts that are softened or delayed. So that measure passed the Senate 73-26. And then today, Thursday, the House, before they headed to the airports, gave final approval to a Paul Ryan budget. And this is a really ugly, ugly budget. It not only locks in the sequester cuts for the remainder of this fiscal year, which ends in October, but it imposes the worst of the Paul Ryan plan. And it's got some really onerous elements in it. It would repeal Obamacare, eliminate the subsidized insurance exchanges and Medicaid expansion that make up the core of the law. It would undo the Wall Street regulatory law, the Dodd-Frank, passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. And it would cut spending, they say, by $4.6 trillion through 2023. But those numbers are all rubber, you know that. Now, the bill passed with all Democrats and 10 Republicans opposing it. And that's the benefit of having a majority like John Boehner, the Speaker, does. But the math simply doesn't work. And it's one of those Laffer curve bills that says, well, if we cut spending, we'll get more tax revenue. It's just going to happen. And those assumptions, of course, were unproven in the 1980s and proven false in the 1990s. So now they're at it again. And there's about $6 trillion in revenue shortfalls in this Ryan budget. And these are the people who say they don't want to raise taxes. So it's an exercise in futility in some respects. But it gives us a sense of what's going on in Washington and just how reckless the radical Republicans are. And they can't even count. I mean, their budget does not withstand close scrutiny, but they don't care because it responds to their ideological urges of the lowest order. Barack Obama in Israel gave a televised speech to that nation. And as you know, I have criticized the president for traveling to Israel and Palestine without a peace plan. But for the moment here, I'm going to report on this and give him the benefit of the doubt. That he has a new way of reframing the Israel-Palestine conflict, and that by tiptoeing around Israeli sensitivities, that he might be able to move things forward. Now, I'm dubious about this, but his last approach didn't work. Bush spent a lot of time on his futile roadmap. Clinton came very close to securing a deal. But it's been a long time since these issues have been addressed. And in his speech, the president made some pretty important statements and things that certainly made his host government squirm. He said, politically, given the strong bipartisan support for Israel in America, the easiest thing for me to do would be to put this issue aside and express unconditional support for whatever Israel decides to do. And then, invoking some of his rhetoric from the 2008 campaign, he said, political leaders will not take risks if the people do not demand that they do. You must create the change that you want to see. Well, that's good campaign rhetoric, but I'm still waiting for the change that you promised, Mr. President. He went on to say, put yourself in their shoes, referring to the Palestinians. Look at the world through their eyes. It is not fair that a Palestinian child cannot grow up in a state of her own and lives with the presence of a foreign army that controls the movement of her parents every single day. It is not just when settler violence against Palestinians goes unpunished. It's not right to prevent Palestinians from farming their lands, to restrict a student's ability to move around the West Bank, or to displace Palestinian families from their homes. Neither occupation nor expulsion is the answer, he said. Just as Israelis built a state in their homeland, Palestinians have a right to be a free people in their own land. Now, I give the president credit for making these statements. What's missing is any direct comment on the expansion of illegal settlements on Palestinian land that continues unabated. Maybe he felt that's just kryptonite that could not be touched. Max Fisher, writing in the Washington Post, says that Obama has successfully reframed this issue by assuring Israel of security guarantees that permit them to move on to the next question is, okay, now that we know we have a future, what do we want that future to look like? In his speech, Obama said, quote, given the demographics west of the Jordan River, the only way for Israel to endure and thrive as a Jewish and democratic state is through the realization of an independent and viable Palestine. So I remain skeptical that this visit by the President of the United States will have any measurable impact. But as I said, nothing else is working. And I give the president credit for a speech that was, you know, carefully worded and tried to avoid opening old wounds in a big way without completely sugarcoating the important issues. We shall see. We've been commenting on in this program about the hunger strike underway at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, by the prisoners. And in our in-depth interview with Jess Braven, the Wall Street Journal reporter whose new book is about the kangaroo courts at Gitmo, I asked him what he knew about the actual count of prisoners on a hunger strike. And he said, well, he kind of just didn't know. But I pointed out that the official count released by the Pentagon increased from 14 to 21 over the past weekend. And in a story published yesterday in the New York Times, Charlie Savage ups that count to 25. Now, he notes that the standard used by the Pentagon is that a prisoner's on a hunger strike if he refuses 9 straight meals. And to his credit, Savage points out that lawyers representing some of the detainees say that the number is significantly higher than the official count. And as we've said, our colleague Andy Worthington suggests that the number is well over 100, which is more than half of the people being held there. And of course, why are they doing it? Well, there is a new commandant at the Stalag in Cuba. There have been recent searches of the Koran that offended Islamic prisoners who've told their lawyers that this represents a return to an older regime at Gitmo that was widely identified with the mistreatment of detainees. But it's interesting, they quote a defense lawyer, David Reams, and unnamed military officials as agreeing, quote, that a significant factor in the recent unrest is the collapse of hopes that the United States government would at some point let them go. Well, duh. The Daily Beast reports in an exclusive today that 3 different sources in the defense and intelligence establishments say that the White House is about to sign off on a plan to shift the secret drone program that kills individuals, over 4,700 to date, from the control of the CIA to the exclusive control of the Defense Department. Now, this is interesting because, first of all, I don't believe it. I do think that the Obama administration recognizes its vulnerability on this program, and they want to offer a little truthiness, a little bit of limited hangout, as Richard Nixon once said. But keep in mind, as I've pointed out, that John Brennan, who shifted from the White House, got confirmed as CIA director before he left His last project was to compile the so-called playbook for drone strikes. And in it, he left a huge loophole for the CIA. Yeah. He set himself up. And this suggests to me then maybe there will be a shift and that most of the drone strikes will be run out of the Defense Department. But I don't think for a minute that the CIA is getting out of the drone game. And this article in the Daily Beast points out that the CIA's program is covert, which means it's not only highly classified, it is deniable under law. And it says that in theory, the CIA can lie about the existence of the program, as they have been doing until a court last week said, nah, that game is up. But the military's targeted killing program is merely clandestine. It's secret, but they say not deniable. Oh, that makes me feel so much better. In South Korea yesterday, there was a massive internet attack traced to a Chinese IP address. It hit a major network, shut down 32,000 computers at 6 banks and media companies in South Korea. And in the blame game, everybody points fingers at North Korea using a Chinese computer to disguise the origin of this attack. South Korean regulators say they believe the attacks came from a single organization. And I don't want to go way deep into conspiracy theories here. It certainly is most likely that North Korea is the originator of this attack. But let's just keep in mind that our government has recently announced the expansion of our offensive cyber warfare capabilities. And that's coming out of the clandestine world a little bit. We've been doing it for a while, but they're being a little more upfront. There is this cyber warfare division now being built at the Pentagon. And so I would not exclude as a suspect an attack originated by the United States against South Korea using computers in China in order to blame North Korea. Just a theory. It's entirely possible the North Koreans did this and the U.S. hands are clean. Call me cynical. Here in California, we have had seismic peace for a number of years. The last big earthquake here in Northern California was in 1989. Southern California, the Northridge quake, 92 or 93. And there is a system being developed to predict earthquakes. Actually, it would be more accurate to call it an early warning system. They can't really predict. But by laying out sensors up and down the state and connecting them to a computer network, they're able to pick up signals. And so last week at Caltech in the seismology laboratory, the computer alarm sounded that there was a 5.2 underway about 100 miles from the laboratory. And this is kind of exciting news. Now, I want to be clear. They say that the most they can give you is about a minute warning. By the time that gets flashed out through the media or on smartphones and computer networks, only a certain number of people will receive that alert in time to do anything about it. But it's better than nothing. And in our experience with the technological advances, often our capabilities improve when we practice. Problem here? They need a mere $80 million to complete the program that is underway at Caltech now. And the state doesn't have it. And the cost of a major shaker in California would be in the billions. And so to spend $80 million to prevent or to minimize billions in damage seems like a good investment. Isn't there a Silicon Valley billionaire who can step up? Meg Whitman, what are you doing with your money? Why don't you whip out your checkbook and do something about it? You may have heard about the city of Bell. It's in Los Angeles County. And there are only a couple of hundred residents there. But there was a group of cronies who got elected to the city council and helped themselves to the city's treasury. Looting is not too strong a term. The city manager was taking in $1.5 million a year. His salary was $800,000, and then there are all kinds of sweeteners on top of that. He faces a trial in a few months. But his buddies on the city council were just found guilty, with one exception, of paying themselves huge salaries while raising taxes on residents, and they were convicted of multiple counts. And let's clear the innocent. Former Councilman Luis Artiga was cleared entirely. City council members were making $100,000 a year. Oh, and I misspoke. It's 36,000 people in this town of Bell. I thought it was in the hundreds, but 36,000. And finally, here in the Bay Area, our friends at the American Civil Liberties Union are filing a lawsuit because Governor Jerry Brown has twice vetoed smart bills written by a great state senator named Mark Leno from here in San Francisco, which would require a warrant from a judge before the police can search the contents of your cell phone. This arises out of a case of an activist here in San Francisco named Robert Offer Westort. He worked for the Coalition on Homelessness, and he took part in a protest a year ago January. He was arrested for pitching a tent in a park in the city. They handcuffed him at the station, took his mobile phone from his pants pocket, and searched it. He said an officer actually read some of the text messages aloud, some of which he hadn't even seen yet, and later put them in the police report. They also held onto the phone for another 4 or 5 months and left indications that they read new messages as they came in. All of this without a warrant, and they claimed under the authority of a state court ruling, a state Supreme Court ruling, which had relied on federal cases and did not address the state constitution. In January 2011, the California Supreme Court ruled 5-2 that police did not need a warrant to search the cell phone of someone they had arrested, saying that we have no privacy rights in anything that we're carrying when taken into custody. I think this is a very clear-cut issue. I'm looking at a file cabinet across the room here. If cops want to search it, they need a warrant. There's more information in my smartphone than is in that file cabinet. They don't need a warrant? By the way, in the meantime, privacy rights advocates suggest you password protect your cell phone. It'll at least slow the cops down and give you a little more control over their access to your phone. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This podcast is free. Share it.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.